And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. I hope it will be for all of you. Now, it's not my intention to make light of my first topic for the year, which I can tell you now is the global economy. But as you, dear listeners, might still be on vacation, or at least some of you, I'll start what might sound like a rather heavy topic with a few lighthearted remarks, jokes, actually, about economists and at the expense of economists, if only to let the new year in. Well, look, here goes. You probably are not aware that there are only three economist jokes in the whole wide world, and I know both of them. Two economists were sitting at a nudist colony. The one said, "Have you read Marx?" The other said, "It's these wicker chairs." And the last one is one we can debate with my guest today. Economic forecasters assume everything except responsibility. Well, look, listeners, please don't hold them against me. I aim to improve in this new year. And now to my first guest of 2023. It's 9 years since she was on my show, and I'm delighted to welcome her back. So much has changed in the global economy and other crucial areas too. My guest is Vicky Price. She's currently Chief Economic Advisor and board member at the Center for Economics and Business Research, which is an independent economic consultancy based in the UK, and a professor at King's College London. And she's been a friend of mine for many, many, many years. In 2014, I described her then as a woman who's had a glittering career as an economist. Listeners, it has continued to glitter and glitter brilliantly. I hear her regularly on sensible UK radio and TV talk shows do her best to explain what is going on in the global economy. And she's also written numerous books, including on women in the economy and also the economics of Greece. She was a high flyer in Britain's civil service, becoming the first woman to be appointed to the post of Director General in the British government's business department, Business and Skills, I think it was called, and joint head of the UK government's economic service. Born in Athens, she moved to London when she was a teenager, and she pursued her academic studies at the London School of Economics and a professional career in Britain. Her visiting professorships are too long to mention, but they included City University's Cass Business School, Imperial College Business School, and Nuffield College, Oxford. She's also been a member of the Council of the University of Kent, the Royal Society for the Arts, and a governor of the London School of Economics. I remember our first interview in the spring of 2014 clearly, because we talked of the possible exit of Greece from the Eurozone, which, as we now know, never happened. But in our conversation, she taught me a new word, one I'd never heard before. But since June 2016, it's become part of the British lexicon, and that word was Brexit. I've no doubt that I shall learn a lot of new things today as she joins me via Zoom from the UK. Vicky Price, Happy New Year. Welcome back to the McKay Interview.
Thanks very much, Michael. Happy New Year to you.
It's good to see you again, Vicky. Vicky, we've got a lot to discuss, so I'll get straight to the point. Economics is complex. It's not a physical science like physics, because its essence is human behavior. It's called a social science. And as I have already warned you that I want to ask you about the global economy, you'll have guessed that some of my questions will be impossible to answer, even for such an experienced economist as yourself, in only half an hour or so. But I ask you please to do your best, because our educated audience are not, in the main, economists, and like me, seek better, clearer understanding of complex issues that affect them, their families and communities, and yes, their countries too. So Vicky, to begin with, please give me a succinct overview of the state of the global economy as you see it on this fourth day of the new year, 2023. In other words, the big picture. Perhaps you'd like to salami-size my question and respond in digestible portions. Let's start with Europe and the Eurozone, and then move on to then the USA, then China, Japan, India, Asia, and finish up, if we have time, with the world's most youthful and fastest growing population, Africa. But let's start with Europe and the Eurozone, Vicky. Over to you.
Well, thank you. Well, Europe and the Eurozone, this has been, of course, 2022 has been a year of huge uncertainty about what will be happening to Europe, mainly because, of course, the war in Ukraine, the cut of gas supplies to the region from Russia. A lot of concern about how the economies would be affected, and dire predictions, actually, were coming for 2022. The interesting thing is that quite a lot of those dire predictions have not proved to be correct, and Europe has managed reasonably well overall. We saw growth of something over 3% in GDP, both in the Eurozone and in the EU as a whole. Huge differences, of course, across the region, depending on which country you were in. But overall, the economies have done reasonably well. The concern is what's going to happen, of course, in 2023, and whether that resilience, if you like, that was shown by finding alternative sources of energy, for example, bringing LNG from the US in quite substantial numbers, and also rethinking energy policy more generally and cutting consumption, which was really interesting. But nevertheless, towards the end of 2022, we did see a bit of a slowdown, even though there's still growth in some parts of Europe, and particularly in southern Europe, where we've seen places like Greece, where I originally come from, as you mentioned, in fact, growing by over 5% in 2022, the fastest growth in the Eurozone. So what we have therefore seen is a sort of mixed picture, but what was going to happen now in 2023 remains, of course, very much dependent on what happens with the war in Ukraine and what the implications for that might be for energy prices. So the forecasts are for growth, if you look at what the European Commission is expecting, of possibly, you know, just over zero. So 0.3% is what is forecast at present for the EU and the Eurozone, which isn't very much, of course, but at least it's not quite the recession that had been feared. Within that, of course, we are likely to see places like Germany possibly seeing a fall in GDP, maybe Italy. Those are the two countries that were most dependent on Russian gas in the past. And of course, that will affect what happens elsewhere. So a mild recession is really what people are now expecting, rather than something really deep. Whether that proves to be the case is, of course, you know, questionable. Much will depend, as I said, on developments in Ukraine and what Russia does next.
Well, Vicky, just to interject a layman's question to you as a specialist, when you say you talk about zero growth, is that a net or is that a gross figure? I mean, do you take inflation into account in that statistic? Because we know that there is inflation in the European economies, and we're going to come on to that later.
No, quite right. No, that's real. So we're not talking about nominal GDP, yes, which of course will be expanding, but that's real. And that is, of course, also affecting the views of the markets, if you like, in relation to where the euro might be. And of course, the sort of slow growth in the economy is never particularly good. And people are comparing it, of course, with what may be happening in the US, where, again, we've seen a bit of a slowdown there. And we had recession in the first half of 2022.
Well, tell me more about the United States of America. What's going on over there?
Yes, it's quite a mixed picture again. We saw a decline in GDP in the first quarter of 2022, another decline in the second quarter. So the US moved into a technical recession. It wasn't very deep. And then there's been a recovery since. Although towards the end of 2022, we've seen some slowdown taking place. We've seen also employment figures, although they're still positive, slowing down. So a lot of new jobs have been created, but not at the pace that were created before. Nevertheless, the US is quite resilient because it's quite self-sufficient in terms of energy. And there is a lot of money that can be put into the economy to support growth for the future. So a lot of that is going on. And the US is also developing quite a lot of its own defenses, if you like, by subsidizing quite considerably investment in the US on climate change, for example, on energy saving devices and innovations. So there is a concern now that the US is trying to, you know, if you like, support its own manufacturing at the expense of others, concerns about whether this is within WTO, World Trade Organization rules. But there is no doubt that the country as a whole, being sort of vast and rich, is much more resilient than other parts of the world to what's happening in Russia.
And if we look eastward now to China, to Japan, India, and the rest of Asia, what do you see there?
Well, China is an interesting case because when you think back of what happened in 2020, China was about the only, you know, country of note to have avoided an actual drop in GDP in the year as a whole, even though at the beginning of 2020, there was a sharp decline because COVID, of course, was started there. And they shut down quite considerably as a result. And of course, everyone else sort of cancelled all their orders to China. So, and then there was a huge bounce back in the second half of 2020. And that growth continued through 21 and 22. But what we've seen more recently is, of course, real concerns about the impact of policy to avoid all these various variants of COVID we all went through by a zero COVID policy, with the result that the economy itself slowed down, even though there was still growth. And a lot of manufacturing also sort of ground to a halt because with zero COVID policy, you know, nobody could circulate around, and service sector also was affected. So China slowed down quite considerably towards the end of 2022. And what we're seeing now is, with this zero COVID policy being reversed, opening up, loads and loads of COVID cases are hitting China. And there will be disruption in production too during the first half, certainly, of 2023. The expectations are that the economy will then bounce back towards the end of the year. But it matters hugely for the rest of Asia, as you asked the question, because obviously places like Japan and others all depend very much on exporting to China. And if China sort of closes down for a bit or is unable to even have enough people for any manufacturing production, then A, the supply chain issues for the rest of the world are affected. But also, of course, exports to China are affected too, because basically production is disrupted. Nobody wants to import anything from anyone else. So that will affect the whole region. And that's one of the issues. Now, India is very different. India has been growing, probably grew throughout the whole of that period. It is, of course, a very large economy. It's been benefiting from being able to buy quite cheap oil from Russia. It has some sort of agreement on that. It is benefiting from whatever pickup there was in world trade in 2022, which was quite sharp, and 21 and 22. What's happening now, though, is because such a large part of the world is still suffering now from high inflation, low wages, not picking up enough, and therefore real incomes declining, concerns about the various waves of COVID or energy costs also affecting business investment. What we're seeing is that world trade is slowing down very significantly, and the World Trade Organization is forecasting just 1% growth trade. No, for the world as a whole, which means, to affect India as well. So trade is very important for a large part of the world, and not only, of course, India and others, but also, you know, if you look at Africa, where, you know, if commodity demand sort of slows down, or that would affect them as well. So there is a big issue, really. But again, if you look at Africa, for example, there's a difference. If you look at North Africa, you know, the countries that have gas, for example, are able to export quite a lot of that to Europe that needs it. You know, if you look at other parts of Africa, then obviously they're much more dependent on what happens to oil prices. If you look at the oil producing ones, whether it's Nigeria, of course, or Angola, you know, all those areas are benefiting quite considerably from high energy prices. But of course, if those slow down, as has been forecast, then obviously they would be affected as well. So there's quite a lot of discrepancy. If you look at the entire region of Africa, there's big differences that exist between those commodity producers and the others, who depend much more on sort of trade. Food prices, of course, have gone up quite significantly. It affects some countries worse than others, but those that export the food have probably done quite well. Those that depend on importing it, if you look, for example, at sort of Middle East, you look at Lebanon, you look at other places that have really been affected by wheat prices being very high, for example, then you've got that discrepancy there. And with it, of course, a rethink of which countries are, if you like, viable for the longer term, with big issues of debt that was collected and increased very significantly during COVID.
Yeah, and Vicky, as you look at your sort of world map, which of the countries, and I mean, it's an invidious question to ask you, but in which of the countries stand out as the ones that you think will continue to grow reliably, consistently, and what are they doing right, if it's possible to put it that way, and which are the economies that you see as being in decline or just spluttering, neither up nor down? I mean, tell me which countries you choose.
It's an interesting question, but a very, very difficult one, because you asked about consistently and reliably. I mean, first of all, of course, we've still got issues with climate change and how affected they are. Droughts affecting loads of places, floods affecting, Pakistan and others. And so you've got that issue which needs to be tackled. And what the World Bank is worried about is that a very large number of countries were facing and probably will still be facing food catastrophe scenarios. Not really necessarily due to the war in Ukraine and the blockage for a while, although that's now stopped being the case, at least temporarily, of grain exports from Ukraine and Russia, but also because of the fact that temperatures have gone up and down in such a way that have affected food production, which probably is going to be an issue for some time to come. And not just the export of fertilizers that people haven't been able to get their hands on, again, with Ukraine sort of being such a big exporter of that and Russia, but also what happens domestically. And we've seen that also in North America. There were periods when, Canada wasn't able to produce enough of its own food that it was exporting quite considerably. We've seen things happening in South America. So what you've got therefore is a lot of uncertainty, and what is required is a lot of investment in ensuring that this is dealt with somehow for the longer term, and a lot of transfer of resources from the richer nations to the poorer ones. And that hasn't really happened, and that's what puts a big question mark in terms of sustainability, which is really the question you asked. In terms of who gets it right, I'm afraid, yes, of course, there are some small countries that do quite well. You were talking to me from Switzerland. I mean, actually, interestingly enough, it's had a good overall 2022, with output still growing in manufacturing, for example, even though that growth has slowed down a little bit through the course of the year, but not doing badly at all, so positive. And you've had other countries in Asia, smaller countries, whether it's Singapore, doing well. And that, even though they've also, of course, also had their COVID scares. But overall, I would suggest that it's the countries that can afford to weather the storms, such as the US, which are likely to prove the winners, or those who are able to invest in the long term. And maybe China will be one of those once it gets through its COVID scare.
I mean, I wanted to ask you very briefly about the UK, but it's really almost a program in itself. But I don't want our conversation, Vicky, to be derailed by Brexit. But I do recall that back in 2014, you had little faith in the Eurozone. But I could not make up my mind when I listened and re-listened to the recording of that interview about where you stood regarding the act of the UK actually leaving the EU, which was still 2 years into the future when we sat together and had our first radio conversation. But my question, if it's possible to be brief on this one, is, was Brexit a decision of great harm, self-harm to the UK, or only temporary damage, or is it still too early to say? And to give me your reasons for your answer.
Okay, well, first of all, just to go back to 2014, at the time, of course, the Eurozone was in deep crisis, and Mario Draghi had to finally, cut interest rates to negative, which remained negative until last July, which is extraordinary. So the deposit rate for banks with the European Central Bank, and of course, they had a period of deflation and very low growth. So the UK was doing the right thing in some ways. Being outside of the euro was my belief at the time. But nevertheless, being in the single market was such a good and positive thing for growth, for the economy, and for productivity. And exiting that has been very bad news. And all the evidence is suggesting that our business investment has suffered since the vote. And since we left a couple of years ago, what we've seen is that the export performance of the UK has suffered as a result, and costs have increased, and bureaucracy has increased very significantly, and loads of smaller exporters have given up. And that's very bad news, because for an economy to do well, you need a vibrant export sector, because you compete a lot more when, or you need to compete a lot more when you export, and you're forced, if you like, to invest and innovate. And without that competitiveness just goes away. And unfortunately, the UK has suffered very much in that respect. And the expectation is that over the long term, in fact, a lot of it may have happened already, GDP will be something like 4% lower than it would otherwise be. And if you add to that, of course, the fact that it takes quite some time to recover from COVID, I mean, here we are in the UK, still below pre-pandemic levels, whereas the rest of Europe is above it. And all the G7 countries are above it. Which is really extraordinary. And Brexit is blamed for some of that. Plus, it has caused more supply chain issues because of the fact that we used to depend so much on what happens in Europe and importing goods from there to go into manufacturing process. Our prices have been higher as a result in the UK. So inflation has suffered partly because of that. And also, of course, we have lost quite a lot of people from the labour force. And we have, therefore, more of a pressure on wages than the rest of Europe.
Let me just remind our listeners that my first guest of 2023 is leading economist Vicky Price, and she's talking to me about her view of the global economic scene via Zoom from the UK. Vicky, we're just over a month away from an infamous anniversary in Europe, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022, and war in Europe. Please explain the economic and social impact of the rising costs of energy. This might sound like an obvious question with an equally obvious answer, but I suspect that you, as a professional economist, see things that non-specialists like me do not.
Yes, well, the impact of the conflict is quite a shock to the world economy generally, because, of course, it has led to higher energy prices, which we've all suffered, even though in the UK, for example, we imported very little gas and oil from Russia. Most of our gas is either internally produced from the North Sea or we import it from Norway. Nevertheless, the international price of gas has had rocketed for a while. It's come down quite significantly in the last few months, but it's still much higher than it was even a year ago. It has been slow for people to realize that this is a real crisis which isn't going to go away. It's a little bit like COVID. You have to react to it. And of course, countries have reacted to it by supporting households, supporting businesses, but they have reacted to this in a very different way depending on which country you're looking at. So Germany, for example, has just announced yet another package, very large, substantial, hundreds of billions of package to support the economy through this current crisis. We've seen other places like the UK doing a little bit, but nothing like as much as others have done. In fact, if anything, in the UK, we've had both a tightening of monetary policy and a tightening of fiscal policy to deal with inflation in particular. We've seen, because of this energy crisis, that countries have had to borrow more. So the expectation had been that post-COVID, one could go back to normal, but actually you can't do that. So that's been another change. So we are still going to end up, when the war finishes, when and if it does, with countries still being very heavily indebted, and something will have to be done about that. And we now have, of course, because of this inflation impact, which has had in it also inevitably affected, the sort of wage demands of individuals. We have lots of strikes in the UK. It has meant that real disposable incomes have suffered and are falling. And that's quite a shock again to the system after a number of years of suffering from the COVID impacts. So there has not been an easy passage. And the international organizations are all quite concerned about what it will all mean. And I think we started the discussion talking about what's going to happen to the economies. Well, the concern right now by the likes of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank is that because we are moving interest rates up, in many of the developed parts of the world and in some others as well, it looks like a synchronized increase in interest rates. And that, of course, means that one is making the life even more expensive for people, not just inflation, but also mortgages. I mean, house prices are beginning to fall in lots of places. They had done incredibly well because of such low interest rates before. Now, of course, they're starting to fall. And that's a big, big issue. The wealth effect will be important. Will people go out and consume? And that's the essence of why the forecasts for 2023 have been so downgraded. And people say, well, you know, we had a bad 2022. Why should 2023 be so bad? Well, it's the impact of all these things which are now affecting both the consumer and businesses, which is a combination of the factors that we've been discussing through the program, which end up leading everyone to think that 2023 would be pretty bleak. And of course, it could get worse if the war escalates.
Vicky, one topic which is confined to the relatively rich and prosperous North, including Japan, is aging populations. The other is climate change. But first about aging population, when you study the data, what do you see and what conclusions do you come to regarding action which populations here in the North and their governments need to take?
Well, one of the simplest things to do, of course, is increase the retirement age. And what we're finding is that there is a lot of resistance to that. In some countries it's happening, in others it's not. And yet that is one way in which to at least restrict the amount of your GDP that goes into keeping older populations going, if you like. The other one, of course, is to relax immigration rules. And that's a pretty difficult one.
That's a political hot potato in many countries.
Absolutely. And, you know, Japan is a very good case, to look at, where they're not particularly keen to do so. And yet they do have an aging population issue. Working longer is perhaps the best answer. But migration is happening. I mean, look at Germany, where, you know, the population forecasts were for a decline in the next decade or so. Well, now, of course, with this big migration that took place following the war in Syria, for example, and Merkel's opening up of Germany's borders, then that may be delayed for a while. But if you look at lots of other countries, they are still forecasting population declines coming, and that's going to be very, very expensive for individuals. So changing also the way in which pensions are funded, maybe another way of going about it. But there have been calculations by the OECD and others on what works best. And if I remember correctly from looking at those, the raising of retirement age is the thing. But look at France, for example, which is having difficulty right now getting that pension reform through. So as you rightly said, it's often
not just
migration.
Easy answers, huh?
Yeah, no,
and climate change, again, this is obviously could be the subject of just one single conversation, but is it really the existential crisis that some with the loudest voices seem to beat their breasts about? But as an economist, what do you see as sensible solutions to saving the planet when you look at what's happening through your lens?
Well, one can achieve perhaps through sort of a lot of nudging, if you like, a reduction in energy consumption. And we've seen that the euro area or the EU has actually managed that reasonably well over the last year. But there's a limit because, of course, you have quite large energy intensive sectors, and just sort of abandoning those is a bit difficult. There is now discussion about whether, you know, these high energy prices mean that Europe will deindustrialize. I think that's probably exaggerated as a worry. I think there will be other ways in which one can make up for whatever one does not import from Russia, or perhaps, you know, who knows, the whole issue may be resolved one day. But the reality is that one has to be very innovative and spend a lot of money investing in new technology. And I think it's the technology that will do it. Rather than anything else, because obviously as various other countries start growing faster in the future, because it's the natural thing for them to do, whether it's Africa or other less developed regions, they will be consuming more energy, and they will want to consume more energy. And the forecast is of a very substantial increase in energy demand worldwide over the next few decades. So something needs to give, and what needs to give is, I'm afraid, it's technology. And that's where a lot of the investment should be.
Vicky, can I ask you a slightly different question? We're of the same generation, I guess. We're both raising young families in Britain in those high inflation and high interest rate years of the late 70s and early 80s. And those times bring back mixed memories for me, as many countries, including the UK, seem to be heading that way again. But my question here is inflation. Is inflation wholly bad and destructive, or can good things be said of it, or indeed come out of it?
For governments, it's interesting, of course, because politically it's not very good to have high inflation. Quite a lot of your debts, if they are, of course, nominal debts, assuming, of course, your wages can rise as well, get reduced in terms of value. So that's good news from one point of view. And that, of course, applies for the government as well. The only problem is that some of those bonds that are issued are index linked and therefore go, you know, your costs go up with that inflation going up as well. And if your interest rates rise, as they have done, then again, borrowing becomes quite expensive. So yes, you can win on one side, but lose on another side. So there are some benefits of higher inflation, but hyperinflation of the type that we used to see in the late 70s and also early 80s is not very good if it carries on, because it can be very destructive. Yes.
Yeah. Vicky, what about the behaviour of central bankers since the economic crash of 2007-08 with regard to printing money? The modern-day euphemism is quantitative easing. Intuitively, this seems like a bad idea. It kicks a potentially toxic can down the road. It avoids hard truths. Is people's hard-earned money safe with central bankers, or is that not the question that economists ask?
Well, quantitative easing is being blamed for some of the inflation increase we've seen, although, you know, frankly, a lot of the recent uptick in inflation has been because of the war in Ukraine and the impact on energy prices. Yes, of course, energy prices had increased already. And interestingly enough, oil prices are now below where they were before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So because basically the world slowed down quite significantly after that. But there was no way in which the world economy could have survived COVID if QE hadn't happened. In other words, if the central banks hadn't intervened and supported the issuing of bonds by governments, which allowed them then to redistribute quite a lot to the economy. So in other words, the various finance departments, the Treasury in the UK and the various departments across the developed nations in particular, had to borrow very extensively, a lot more than they thought they would have to do in 2020 and then again in 21 and now again in 22, and they will continue to do so in 23. But they were able to do it quite cheaply. So the interest rates which they had to pay for that debt remained very, very low, in some cases even negative in places like Germany, because the central banks, in the case of the Eurozone, of course, it was the ECB, intervened in a very substantive way by buying all those bonds in the secondary market and keeping those yields down. So, yes, of course, their balance sheets increased very significantly. Loads and loads of bonds they now think they have to get rid of slowly, one hopes. But without that, the support that was given to the markets and to you know, the financial system and to individuals would not have happened. So we needed it. The question was, should we carry on, or should we have carried on, or should the central banks have carried on for as long as they did, given that the economies were recovering? Well, the truth is that there was still huge uncertainty. We still, a year ago, had various variants that we were worried about. Remember the Omicron variant just a year ago?
Yeah.
And also concerns about whether, you know, suddenly everything would sort of collapse and whether we'd be going back to deflation. So the beginning of 2022, the expectation was that, yes, inflation picked up, but I mean, not hugely. It was above target, above the 2% target, but prices were going to stabilize. Supply chain issues were improving. Energy prices were stabilizing as well. Commodity prices more generally were beginning to ease. So if even if the prices stayed where they were through the course of 2022, you would see a very substantial drop in inflation and a return to target by the end of the year. So there wasn't really any serious reason for raising rates or doing anything different to what you did before. But of course, then we had the war in Ukraine and everything changed. So yes, you can blame QE up to a point. But I think those who complain about it are probably the true monetarists, who think that any expansion in money supply is a bad thing and will lead to inflation. Whereas, you know, we can blame the war in Ukraine for a large part of what we're seeing at present.
Vicky, last question. The Economist magazine recently wrote that the biggest mistakes in economics are failures of imagination that reflect an assumption today's regime will last forever. It never does. Change is coming, The Economist says. But as you look ahead to this new year, what kind of change do you anticipate? And is the economic glass half full or half empty in your view?
I'd say it's half full. I think one has learned an awful lot from what's happened in the last 3 years, how to deal with crisis. And it's quite interesting because, again, you reminded me of what we discussed in 2014. If only we had the COVID crisis first and the financial crisis after, because a lot of what was done in the financial crisis with austerity, tightening up, threatening Greece, the Stability and Growth Pact, all those restrictions that were there, it didn't really lead to any sustainable growth or even improvements in productivity in the Eurozone or frankly in other countries that adopted similar policies. In fact, we started the COVID crisis with GDP per head in some countries being still below in Europe, below where it was pre-financial crisis. I mean, that's no good. That doesn't help. And with this crisis, with the COVID crisis, a lot of those rules have been suspended or abandoned. The IMF, World Bank were suggesting spend more if you can, please. They were all in favor of reducing rates. The ECB's policy of not buying, junk bonds during its QE period was also abandoned. And of course, they bought loads of Greek bonds, which had moved away from being junk anyway for, a little while before. But basically, they relaxed loads of rules. Stability and Growth Pact has now been suspended. So things have been learned. The one worry one would have is that following this energy crisis, where again, people are thinking very innovatively, how do we replace the oil that we were getting and gas we're getting from Russia? Did we do the right thing about nuclear in Germany, for example, deciding not to go for that for the future? Why did Germany not build any LNG platforms? Now it's doing so very fast. And the use of coal in the future or anything else that perhaps needs to be done to get us back to some sort of normality. But that normality will be very, very different to where we were before. So I think lessons have been learned. We've seen a lot of innovation taking place, a lot of rethinking. The geopolitics have all changed. So we're not going back to where we were. Things are changing, and I think we've been finally realized that you can't rely on where you were before. And that, of course, will also touch on climate change. So I'm actually quite optimistic
Well, that's good. That's a great way
that,
to start the year. Vicky, you've enlightened me, and I'll need time to gather my thoughts again on another occasion, ask you all the questions that have arisen from this fascinating conversation. But thanks so much for making time for me. My guest today has been Vicky Price, Chief Economic Advisor and Board Member at the Centre for Economics and Business Research in the UK and a professor at King's College London. Thank you, Vicky.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.